Thank you very much, Michael, and thanks for the opportunity to speak with you all today. I have to say this is quite strange, so bear with me, and I hope that you get something out of this speech and this Q&A. So the title of my speech is The Housing Market and Financial Stability. Now, when the pandemic hit Australia in early 2020, policymakers entered a world of unknowns. The health situation required a drastic curtailment of much economic activity. There was fiscal and monetary policy, though they both responded quickly and strongly. Governments provided substantial financial support to firms and individuals who overnight had lost businesses and jobs. The Reserve Bank reduced interest rates to historically low levels, and we also introduced a suite of other policy measures to lower funding costs and interest rates across the economy. The banks, they offered borrowers deferrals on their loan repayments. There were moratoriums on evictions and rent relief for businesses and households. And the idea, as the governors described it, was that we were building a bridge to get us to the over the other side of the economic crevasse that we had been created by the pandemic. Now, actually, at that time in 2020, we were writing our financial stability review, which would be released in April 2020. And things were changing so quickly at the time that we seemed to be rewriting it daily. It ended up being quite a different style of review than we would typically produce. It had quite a substantial focus on the ability of the financial system to absorb the shock and support the economy. But it also focused on the potential implications for household and business balance sheets. And in particular, we noted the decline in demand in the residential property market at the time, and we highlighted the risks that this could pose to highly indebted households. And I'll quote from our April 2020 financial stability review. We said, "A key financial stability risk is the extent to which the weakness in economic activity spills over to the housing and commercial property markets. The prospect of large declines in property prices presents significant balance sheet risks for households, businesses, and lenders." Now, 18 months later, here we are, and we're drafting our financial stability review, which will come out in October. And we're not talking about financial stability risks from housing debt due to given falling residential property prices. Rather, what's happening is we're monitoring the surprising and rather dramatic rebound in the housing market, and we're asking ourselves whether there are financial stability risks from these developments and the accompanying rise in housing credit. Although it's not property prices per se that we care about from a financial stability perspective, developments in the housing market, including prices, they provide information on the emergence of financial stability risks. So today what I want to do is set out for you how we think about the housing market in the context of financial stability. So I'll just get a couple of graphs up. So let me start with a little bit on the housing market. So it has been very buoyant. After initially declining a bit at the onset of the pandemic, housing prices have recovered strongly, and you can see that in this chart. Despite some moderation during the recent lockdowns in New South Wales and Victoria, the strength has been broad-based across states and across metropolitan and regional areas, and it's been particularly in detached housing. So in this environment, it's been unsurprising that credit growth has picked up, and the rapid rebound in loan commitments suggests some further pickup in growth to come. Growth in housing credit is currently running at an annualised rate of about 7%. Recent data on commitments, though, which you can see in the left-hand panel of this graph, suggests that they're still remaining quite high. And if we combine that with some assumptions, that suggests that housing credit growth could peak at an annualised rate of about 11% early next year. Now, there's a number of factors driving this strength. First up would be low interest rates. They're clearly a very important factor because they make it easier for households to service their debt. And they also change the trade-off between whether to rent or buy. a house. Also important has been the government support for housing construction, including the Home Builder Scheme. And growth in housing credit in late 2020 and early 2021 was driven by loan commitments for the purchase of new dwellings or housing construction, reflecting this support. More recently, however, there's signs that credit growth is increasingly being driven by purchases of existing dwellings, in which turnover is currently quite high. Now, the strength of the housing market is a positive for the economy, and indeed, it's an important channel for monetary policy to support the economy. It does this through housing construction, through home improvements, and through purchases of household items. In fact, strongly rising housing markets and housing credit have been a feature of many countries over the past 18 months, as monetary policy everywhere has lowered lending rates and governments have provided fiscal support. However, while household debt to income in Australia hasn't increased much over recent years, it is at a high level, something we've highlighted in our financial stability reviews in the past, both historically and relative to other countries. So sustained growth in credit in excess of income growth may result in vulnerabilities building in bank and household balance sheets. Now, what does this imply for financial stability risks? So there's two interrelated channels through which the housing market could have implications for financial stability: bank balance sheets and household balance sheets. So I'll start with the banks. The Australian banks are very exposed to the Australian housing market. Around 60% of their lending is for housing, and you can see that in this chart. And housing is also a common collateral for loans to small and medium businesses. So a decline in housing prices impacts the value of that collateral, but of itself does not necessarily lead to losses. If there were an economic shock that resulted in borrowers being unable to service their debt, however, and at the same time housing prices fell sharply, then the debt would be unable to be recovered in full by the sale of the property, and this would result in a loss to the banks. If the losses were large enough, the banks might exacerbate the decline by reducing their lending. Now, there's two broad mitigants against this. The first is lending standards and the second is capital. Bank lending standards and practices determine how much risks banks take on. The global financial crisis demonstrated the impact that poor lending standards can have on bank balance sheets. Banks are in the business of taking risk. If they only lent money when they were 100% certain that they would be repaid, there would actually be too little credit. So there's a balance to be struck here. Some loans will go bad, but banks manage those risks by maintaining appropriate standards on who they will lend to and how much. This involves, among other things, standards around serviceability and loan to valuation ratios. Currently in Australia, the evidence suggests that lending standards overall have been maintained in the face of very strong demand for housing. There we go, that's the right one. Sorry about that. This is in contrast to 2014-17, when there were actually signs that lending standards were declining. At that time, the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority took a number of measures to bolster lending standards and curb growth in lending that was posing a higher risk to financial and economic stability. The share of new lending at high loan-to-valuation ratios rose last year, as you can see in this graph. That in part reflected an increase in the number of first home buyers. They tend to have lower deposits. But you'll also see lending at high debt-to-income ratios has risen in the last year or so, and APRA and the bank are monitoring these trends closely. The other mitigant is capital. The more well-capitalised the banking system, the more ability it has to absorb losses. Again, the global financial crisis, which originated in a boom and bust in the housing market in the United States, demonstrated what can happen if banks are not well capitalised. The substantial losses sustained by many banks during that period severely depleted capital positions and resulted in banks pulling back from credit provisions, and in doing so, they amplified the economic downturn. This wasn't so much an issue in Australia, though, since the Australian banks were quite well capitalised at the time. Following that episode, there was a worldwide effort to increase the capital in the banking system through what was known as the Basel III reforms, and they were implemented in Australia by APRA. While the Australian banks did not have the undercapitalisation problems of some overseas banks, they now have even stronger capital positions than they did at the time of the GFC. Indeed, some stress tests undertaken by the bank, and we reported in our October 2020 financial stability review, these stress tests indicated that even a very severe recession and substantial fall in property prices would still leave the banks with capital above their regulatory minima. The strength of the banks has allowed them to respond positively to the pandemic shock, supporting the economy through lending and loan repayment deferrals rather than amplifying the shock. Now that brings me to the second channel through which the housing market could impact financial stability, and that's the household sector. The bulk of household debt in Australia is mortgage debt, that is people borrowing to buy homes. Households that have borrowed a lot to purchase a home relative to their income could, in the event of the shock to their employment status or income, find they are unable to continue to service their loans. This might not be a problem if the value of the loan is less than the value of the property. While it would still be disruptive and stressful to have to sell their home, they would at least be able to repay the debt. However, if the value of the home has fallen substantially since they took out the loan, they will unable to self-cure in this way. And in these circumstances, the banks would incur losses. And if there were enough, like during the GFC, then there could be a substantial impact running from households to banks. But I've already noted above, this currently seems like an unlikely channel in Australia's case, given the strength of bank balance sheets. But there's another channel through which a high level of household debt could have implications for the economy and by extension financial stability, and that's through its impact on consumption. Overexuberance in the housing market can amplify those risks in two ways. First, rapid price rises can increase the likelihood that some new borrowers will overstretch their financial capacity in order to obtain a new loan, and that will make them more likely to reduce their consumption in response to a shock to their incomes. Secondly, if rapid price rises ultimately prove to be unsustainable, they could lead to sharp declines in price and turnover in the future. This in turn could result in reduced spending, both directly as a result of the decline in turnover and through the wealth effect. Next chart. Household debt in Australia has increased substantially over the past 30 years, as you can see in this graph here. Much of this actually occurred in the 1990s and 2000s, as declines in inflation and interest rates and rises in real income meant that people were able to service higher levels of debt. Financial liberalisation in the 1980s also removed some unnecessary credit constraints. Both of these things are permanent shifts, and there's no cause, I don't think, for alarm here. And although household debt to income in Australia is higher than many overseas countries, this can be at least partly explained by the fact that, unlike many other countries, households in Australia own the rental stock and hence they have the debt. And that's rather than overseas, where sometimes it's corporate landlords and specialist firms and pension funds that own the housing stock. Nevertheless, there is quite a bit of international and domestic evidence that suggests that households that have high levels of debt are more likely to curb consumption in response to shocks in income and wealth. A large number of highly indebted households reacting in such a way to an economic downturn or a decline in housing prices could amplify the economic shock. A boom in the housing market, accompanied by an increase in housing debt, could therefore make the economy more susceptible to downturns. For example, in a recession in which a large number of indebted households suffer reduced income, say they lost their job or they got many reduced hours, they might choose to reduce their consumption. It might just be precautionary. But if households are constrained in the sense that they don't have a great deal of income left after meeting their debt servicing repayments and the basics of their lifestyle, they're more likely to reduce consumption. And this will amplify the impact of the economic shock. Another way in which developments in the housing market and debt could impact the economy is through the wealth effect. Sharp declines in housing prices could result in households curbing their consumption, more so if they are highly leveraged, further exacerbating any downturn in the economy. In this sense, sharp rises in housing prices that are not associated with fundamentals could lead to instability by raising the risk of a subsequent decline. This is actually one reason why we watch investor activity in the housing market quite closely. Investors have the potential to amplify movements in housing prices. They buy when prices are rising quickly, but potentially selling when they fall in an effort to avoid a capital loss. Any amplified swings in housing prices will have an impact on the wealth of all households and hence potentially their consumption. As I noted earlier, while picking up, investor activity in the housing market is currently nowhere near the levels it was in 2014 when APRA introduced its investor lending benchmark. And it's hard to judge in real time whether housing prices are out of line with fundamentals. Nevertheless, when prices are rising very rapidly, and there are expectations this will continue, borrowers are more likely to overstretch their financial capacity in order to purchase property. So we're watching developments in housing markets and credit very closely. What can authorities do? Given the potential for risks to be building, there is a question about what the authorities can do aside from monitor developments. Unlike in 2014 and 2017, the concerns this time are not about specific types of lending, such as investor or interest-only lending. So the tools used at that time are not really appropriate at the moment. This suggests that if there were to be a need for so-called macroprudential tools to address rising risks, they should be targeted at the risks arising from highly indebted borrowers. Tools that address serviceability of loans and the amount of credit that can be obtained by individual borrowers are more likely to be relevant. Indeed, we've seen such tools used in a number of countries in recent times, and they could be employed in Australia should the circumstances be judged to warrant it. So in conclusion, the unprecedented monetary and fiscal support to the Australian economy through the pandemic has helped to build a bridge to the other side. The strong recovery in the housing market is part of that bridge. But with the increasing housing prices and housing debt, risks to financial stability could be building. Even though the banks have strong balance sheets and lending standards are being maintained, there is a risk in this environment that households will become increasingly indebted. A high level of debt could pose risks to the economy in the event of a shock to household incomes or a sharp decline in housing prices. It's these macro financial risks that warrant close watching, and whether or not there's a need to consider macroprudential tools to address these risks is something that we're continually assessing. Thank you very much, Michael. I'll hand back to you.
Thanks so much for that, Michelle. That was very, very topical and newsy and hopefully of great interest to everyone who's watching. So what we're going to do now is I'll have a sort of a fireside chat with Michelle for a period. I've already got some questions coming in from the audience. Please feel free to submit questions. I can't say that I'll get to all of them, but I'll try and do my best there. I just wanted to open up, Michelle. You talked about tools that address serviceability of loans and the amount of credit that can be obtained by individual borrowers. What would those tools look like in real life here in Australia?
Thanks, Michael. So I think if we look overseas, there's quite a number of examples of the sorts of tools that that might be considered and in fact have been actively used in many other countries. Things that address serviceability are quite important. So the types of tools that have been used overseas include interest rate buffers to assess serviceability. So at the moment, the way that banks have to assess serviceability is they have to include a certain buffer over interest rates to make sure that people do have the ability to meet, continue to meet repayments in the event interest rates rose. In other countries, they introduce bigger buffers, so that's one possibility. A second possibility are things like debt to income ratios. So some countries have put in what we call portfolio restrictions. So they would say you can't have more than X percent of loans with debt to income ratios over, say, 6. Another tool that's been used overseas, even in our near neighbours, New Zealand, are loan to valuation ratios. So again, the concept is that you might say banks can't have more than X percent of their loans in their portfolio that have loan to valuation ratios over, say, 90%. So these are the sorts of tools, and some countries use them in combinations. But I think they're the sorts of tools that we would also be looking at in the Australian context.
I just wanted to ask you about the average assessment sort of to determine borrowing capacity. If I'm right, it's at about 5.4% now. It was 7.3%, I think, a couple of years ago. I mean, are you comfortable with that level? I mean, it's hard to imagine the RBA, you know, or any central bank raising rates by 3 percentage points in at least, you know, recent times. That certainly hasn't been about. So is 5.4%, you know, does that seem okay to you?
So at the moment, I mean, it's not so much at the moment that we have a floor rate. So let me just go back one step. There used to be a floor rate, which APRA had set, and that floor rate looked reasonably high relative to what interest rates were doing at the moment and in the context of a low inflation environment. So if we were going to introduce an additional buffer here, it would be not so much saying that interest rates could rise by X percent. So it wouldn't be making, it's not essentially saying interest rates, central banks are going to raise interest rates by X percent. But what it would be effectively doing is saying, we want consumers to have a bigger net income surplus, a bigger buffer above their loan repayments than they currently have. So it would be a sort of a device to achieve that. So I wouldn't read so much into it as saying this is what we think interest rates are going to do. It's more saying this is a device, a tool we're going to use to ensure that people's net income surplus is increased.
I just wanted to also ask you about the 6 times borrower's incomes. I was just looking at some data yesterday, and it looks like about a fifth of new loans are being approved at levels at that 6 times rate. This is according to second quarter data, which is obviously generally viewed as higher risk. I mean, is that at a level that starts to become a problem, or are we still some way off from that becoming an issue?
I think it's another example where aggregate numbers sometimes miss a little bit of what's going on. So, yes, it's something that we've been alerted to and we're watching. A couple of mitigating factors, though. On the one hand, there, with the increase in turnover, there seems to be a little bit of bridging loans going on. So people are buying, getting a bridging loan and selling, which increases debt-to-income ratios. So it's not necessarily increased risk. The other thing is that investors, when they're starting to come back into the market, and they tend to have higher debt to income ratios, but they're not necessarily more risky to banks. And I guess the final thing I would say there is that often people with high debt to income ratios actually have high incomes as well. So there are people on low incomes who have high debt to income ratios, they're riskier than people on high incomes that have high debt to income ratios. So there's movement within the aggregate that we're watching, and I think just watching the aggregate by itself doesn't tell you anything. in summary, I'd say, yes, we're watching it, but there are some things going on there that are suggesting to us that we shouldn't be necessarily alarmed at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Just talking about the amount of turnover and the bridging loans, obviously it makes sense to buy a house before you sell it when prices are moving so quickly. What sort of impact do you expect the lockdown, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, to have on the property market? And perhaps an extension of that, what sort of impact do you expect the lifting of the lockdown to have? Because presumably you're going to have more people, more properties coming to market, which perhaps dissipates some of the intensity of bidding on individual properties.
Mm, yeah. So I think we've seen signs that the lockdown in Sydney and Melbourne has dampened activity somewhat. It hasn't had the same impact, I think, as the first lockdown. I think there has been some adaptation, both of sellers and buyers and the real estate industry itself. But we have seen things coming off. What's going on in the market at the moment is reflecting some fundamental shifts in demand. As I highlighted, we've seen regional areas also increasing in value. We've seen detached housing being in particular quite elevated, less so than high density hasn't been doing quite as well. So there's been some shifts in lifestyle and preferences which are impacting. And I would expect some of those things to start to, after lockdown finishes, start to come back into the equation again. But at the same time, there's also lack of population growth and in particular lack of students and those sorts of things. So there's that demand element that currently isn't there, and that's often impacts on the high density area. So there's lots of moving parts at the moment, and I would say that I think things will probably pick up a bit where they're left off. Turnover will spring back, I think. People will start to put things back on the market again. And I think what will be interesting to watch is what happens with the higher density area, the higher density sector, if population growth starts to move up again. But at the moment, that is not being impacted.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, you also mentioned investors there too. Obviously, we're not back at what we saw last decade, but are there any worrying signs with the investor borrowing that you're coming across?
Not at this stage. They are coming back into the market, as we would expect, and having investors in the market is not a bad thing. As I mentioned earlier, investors own the rental stock in Australia, so it's clearly very important that there is rental stock out there for people who aren't purchasing homes or can't afford to purchase a home, that they've got good rental stock available. I think what was going on in 2014-17, when investor lending was growing by over 10% a year, I think there were concerns that it was amplifying the housing cycle. So that was the concern there. At the moment, we're seeing them come back a bit, and there's nothing alarming in that yet, but it's something that we'll keep an eye on.
So we're not looking at tighter restrictions on investor lending. That's not on the horizon in this.
At this stage, that's not on the horizon at this stage. As I said, back in 2014-17, the focus was on investor lending and on interest only lending, and at the time it was as much about microprudential standards that APRA was interested in. It was interested in the banks. It was interested in how the banks were dealing with lending standards and the growth in their portfolios. So it had a very microprudential focus at the time on the institutions. I think what we're talking about now, as I tried to outline in the prepared speech, was that the banks themselves are solid. What we're more interested in now is the build-up of debt in the household sector and the potential implications of that for the economy and what we call macro financial stability.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. just looking internationally, I mean, South Korea's raised interest rates to cool asset prices, and New Zealand's likely to hike next month, again in part to try to cool housing. Do you feel a bit hamstrung, given that the RBA has made fairly clear that it's not going to be using monetary policy to lean into asset prices because, you know, there's wider issues at stake, obviously? I mean, does that make your job that much tougher?
Well, I guess that's why we're having a conversation about macro prudential, what we broadly call macro prudential measures. Around the world, that's basically, I think, now accepted that the monetary policy really should be addressing the macro economy broadly. And if we do have financial stability concerns, then we should be looking to these other tools to try and address those concerns. I think I'd just reiterate what the governor said, which is that at the moment, monetary policy is really needed to get unemployment down and inflation up. And I don't think we can afford to be distracted by that. But other countries have demonstrated, and it's increasingly well accepted that these sorts of other tools can assist in addressing some of these financial stability risks or vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your speech that about our elevated household debt to income ratio. I mean, it's been fairly stable for a while, but you presume it's going to rise from here. I mean, does that add to the risk for households and in turn consumption when interest rates eventually do start to normalise?
Yes, and it not only directly through the impact of if you lose, well, It impacts directly, obviously, because if interest rates rise, you've got less money to spend. To the extent that that was built into the lending standards and interest rate buffers and so on, hopefully that's the sort of thing that's built in and you won't necessarily curb your consumption. But the evidence suggests that people do anyway. They do tend to, whether it's precautionary or whether it is they are constrained, they do tend to, when they are highly indebted, reduce their consumption when recessions happen. So even if they don't lose their job, they might tend to amplify those consumption impacts by doing so. So that's really what we're focusing on. What are the potential vulnerabilities building? As you highlighted, the debt to income ratio hasn't really risen over the past few years. I think, though, that if we continue to see credit, if credit is growing much more quickly than income for the next few years, then that ratio is going to rise and those concerns about the potential vulnerabilities of household balance sheets will start to become to the fore.
I'll just ask one more and then there's a couple of audience questions as well. In some other countries, it's the central bank that controls macroprudential policy. Is it an issue for you that it's APRA that actually holds that responsibility? I mean, you sort of don't have the interest rate lever and then you're having to negotiate with someone else, I guess, to try to work out how to do that.
No, it doesn't. It's there's a variety of models around the world in this. And I think in our case, yes, APRA is the authority that's responsible for these sorts of tools because macroprudential tools and microprudential tools, they're sort of the same thing in many ways, but really the difference is where you're directing it. Are you directing it, as for example, in 2014-17 to the banks themselves and their balance sheets, or have you got something broader in mind? So, it doesn't concern us. We've got an extremely good relationship with APRA. We work closely with them through the Council of Financial Regulators, which is an appropriate forum to do this. And other countries have similar models, and I think it can work very effectively.
I'll ask an audience question here. This is on the rental market. The question is, does the RBA have modelling on domestic rentals? The yields have dropped significantly as risk-free rates reduce, but does the RBA believe that would likely be much less elastic if rates rose again?
Well, we know we don't have modelling on the rental market per se. What we have done quite a bit of modelling on is the sort of rent buy equation. When does it make sense to buy, and when does it make sense to rent? And those models, if you look at those models, that would suggest at the moment that if you take into account the lowering of interest rates, actually it makes sense. Housing prices aren't necessarily that far overvalued. So they're sort of in reasonable line with fundamentals in that sense. So I think that's, now does that suggest that when interest rates rise, the equation may reverse? Yes, it may. In which case you would expect yields to rise and investors to come back into the market. So all these things, that's why I said earlier that investors aren't a bad thing in the market. We need them because they do provide the rental stock. But these things go a little bit in cycles, and I think when you do see interest rates rise, that might reverse that might sort of change the rent buy equation, and that's going to end up affecting yields, and that in the end will end up affecting investment decisions by investors. So, yes, it what goes around comes around in a sense, but there can be lags, and the problem with property sometimes, particularly high density property, is it takes a little while for the building to happen. And in the meantime, you can get sort of rents rising a bit more quickly than they would otherwise. At the moment, there doesn't seem to be an issue with supply of high density, but you never know, that could reverse.
And another one here. Do you have any concerns over concentration of residential lending on certain maturities? For example, the impact of the RBA's TFF on the fixed mortgage market?
Yeah, interesting question. So this has been a question that we've looked at in the past as well. And the concern that we might have, and what we're focusing on really, is when people come off these fixed, will they get sort of interest rate shock in some sense? And that'll affect their ability to meet their repayments. In the past, when we've looked at this, what we've been able to glean from the sort of information we have, in particular some of the disaggregated data, is that most people do have reasonable buffers, and so when they do come off those fixed rate loans, they actually can meet their repayments, and there's only a small portion that can't. I think given the way that the interest rate buffer have been implemented so far by in terms of the lending standards and the way APRA is requiring them, I would expect that would still be the case. Having said that, that is something that we will be carefully monitoring to make sure that we're alert to any issues of interest rate shock coming off those fixed rate loans, because they are at very low levels, as we know. So the interest rate buffers that have been applied to those is going to be a very important mitigant.
This is one, it's quite an interesting one as well. How closely is the bank working with APRA to assess Chinese property sector risk, given the active role now played by mainland banks with many Australian communities?
APRA obviously is the prudential supervisor, so we don't get involved in the individual banking supervision aspects. Our interest from a financial stability perspective is more, as I said, on the system-wide aspects. And at the moment, I would say that probably the system-wide impacts of those banks is not something that's overly of concern for us. But I would expect that if APRA did have those sorts of concerns, we would be talking with them. But very much the prudential side and the individual side is their bailiwick.
Gotcha. Just wanted to raise this one with you, Michelle. So the labour market's shown quite a lot of Australians are working second jobs at the moment. And part of that, I guess, might be people filling positions that were once occupied by temporary migrants. Obviously, they're not around now. But just that nature of people running two jobs or more, I mean, does it raise concerns about, you know, just how precarious people's sources of incomes are when we're talking about, you know, meeting mortgages and these sort of things? Or are they likely to just be young people and not such an issue?
I don't have any particular insights, I don't think, on that specifically. I would say that sort of information and verification of income is the sorts of things that bank lending standards is all about. And when APRA's working with the banks to ensure that they're maintaining their lending standards, the sorts of questions they'll be asking is, how are you verifying income? How are you verifying the precarious that income is? So whether or not these are second jobs, are they casual jobs? These sorts of things will all come into that equation. And I would say, if anything, over the last few years, the banks have really increased their verification and their processes for making sure that they understand this sort of thing about people's income. So it may well be, but that there is more of this going on at the moment. But I suspect, I don't know, but I suspect that it's not really impacting people who are getting loans as such, because lending standards will be, to some extent, ensuring that people aren't in precarious situations because of their income.
Gotcha. So I'll make this the last one, and I'll just bring it back to the Financial Stability Review, which is obviously coming out in just over 2 weeks. Your last one in April was obviously the time when the economy was recovering rapidly, COVID appeared contained. Outside of property, which we've talked about quite a lot, what areas, or have any areas changed significantly, or anything else come to the fore in the intervening period, obviously with, you know, the quite dramatic change in circumstances we've seen in that time too?
I think the main thing is that at the time, I think we felt back then that with the economy recovering, that household balance sheets and business balance sheets were in a very good position. I think what's happened since, obviously, even though we've got government support again and that's helping both on the business and the household side, the vulnerability of household balance sheets and business balance sheets still remains a key issue. And because the economy's, I think what we're talking about now is delayed, not derailed, but nevertheless, the longer it goes, the more risk there is that some of the businesses won't recover, that will have implications for banks, but it'll also have implications for households themselves. So it's, with financial stability, it's always a bit of a balance. I say that I worry no matter what happens. I'm worrying if things are growing too quickly, and I'm worrying if things are in downturn. So my worries have shifted from are things going too quickly and are vulnerabilities building there to are balance sheets going to be impacted, and therefore are we going to see some of the vulnerabilities actually come to light? So I think that would be the main way in which our thinking has changed a little bit since we last wrote it in April.
On that note, I think we'll wind up there. Thank you so much for your time, Michelle. You've been very generous and taking so many questions as well. And I hope for our audience, you've gained some knowledge from that on what is a very, very topical issue at the moment. We'd normally have a round of applause for Michelle, but you just have to imagine it really here, don't you? Yes, thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you on the next Inside Track.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.